I'm just going to put it like this. It's not his cup of tea. Your show maybe wasn't his cup of tea.
Yeah.
Let's put it like that.
Yeah.
He's a more plain meat and potatoes kind of man. I can relate to that. And the Lord's blessed me with this gift to be able to talk to people that are intellectual and to sort of get into that realm. But also, I can relate to the blue-collar guys. So many times on Patrick and Jeremy, we would get calls, and there would be just this guy, this caller that just didn't get Patrick at all, and Patrick didn't get him, and they couldn't relate, and you could tell. And I would bridge that gap, and I think the Lord's blessed me with that ability to understand higher things but also relate to the common people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not meant to be a diss on anyone. So, Mike, send us a message, man. Tell us if you're moving on to the next show. Otherwise, here we are. If you got to duck out, Chris, I'll take this hour. But no, the stuff with the alt-right and the infiltration, it's something I've been investigating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even back in 2017, when after Trump was inaugurated, you know, we were all excited. All the pro-white groups were excited. All the regular American civic nationalists were excited. Everybody was excited. And then he lobbed missiles into Syria.
Yeah.
You know, with the fake baby, gas yeah. baby hoax. And I jumped off, dude. I jumped off hard. And that was my first appearance on RBN in April of 2017. I went on Farron Schoeff's show.
And wasn't Syria in the list of seven countries in 5 years yeah. that Wes Clark mentioned? Anyway.
Well, to Trump's credit, he didn't participate in the overthrow. And he did kind of step back and allow Russia to clean up ISIS in Syria. Again, I'm not a Russia fan. I'm not a Russia, big Russia guy. But you got to admit that, you know, that happened. That was a thing. I mean, Syria is Russia's ally. And, you know, without an administration that was hostile, you had Russia able to come in and sort of stabilize things, if you will, which is, again, why I think you see a lot of pro-white people and white nationalists, you know, total Russia fans. But I did. I jumped off the Trump train and I jumped off the Putin train. And I was just totally critical of all of it. And then I started looking into the alt-right and how it originated. There was actually a Jew in conjunction with Spencer that was pushing this. You had also a Russian oligarch that was non-Jewish named Bosman. Now, Bosman's in Pennsylvania, and he helped fund Russian Insider coming online about 2014. Interestingly enough, Chris, right after the Maidan coup.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, called anti-Semitic and pro-white publication. And I remember the early days of the Daily Stormer, Anglin was really pushing Dugin stuff. You know, again, I don't know Anglin. I haven't talked to him in years. We used to email. I tried to get him on the show, you know, just for an interview. I don't know him personally. I don't know if he's a fed up. I don't know anything about him, all right? But what I do know is that all of these alt-right, over-the-top, you know, things were coming online, and they were using really vicious hyperbole, you know, excuse my language, but talking about gassing the Jews and things like that, and really pro National Socialist stuff. But they were also pushing a Dugin propaganda,
mm-hmm.
Alexander Dugin,
mm-hmm.
In the early days. It just was interesting to me that you had that going on at the creation of this movement.
Yeah. And most people don't see it that obviously, which is fascinating to me. I always think, you know, I mean, maybe you've done some things like this. You know, I remember back in the Ron Paul 2008 election days, in the run up to that, you know, I was involved in some stuff that was related to Ron Paul and some other things. And, you know, we did some stuff where it was a genuine, spontaneous, as much as we can say, you know, to my knowledge, you know, there was no cybernetic hidden hand or anything, that I was aware of, but it was, you know, I would call it a spontaneous, organic demonstration. I've been part of those. And so, A, it's very difficult to get 20 people together for anything. And B, when you do that, you're met with fierce opposition and backlash. And I'm talking about, like, you know, local law enforcement showing up and saying, hey, man, do you have your free speech permission slip? Oh, okay, you guys got to disband. And so when you see things like, for example, after the, you know, I don't even know what to call it, whatever happened on October 7, the, you know, Hamas attacked Israel. That's not, I don't believe that's what happened. But, you know, whatever happened, the same weekend, you have groups around the world demonstrating from Kirkland, Washington to New York, New York, and around the world the same weekend. And there are, you know, Washington Post articles and things talking about people, you know, 500, 700 demonstrators, where you have pro-Israeli, pro-Palestine, you know, groups. How did these groups know to converge on the same spot at the same time? And why were they allowed to do that in these places? And there was no pushback on that. Did they have their free speech chit? Did they have their, you know, permission slip from the nanny state to be able to, you know, assemble? And how did the press know about it? How were they there?
By the way, Chris, I just pulled up the Listen Live on my other phone. We are on the air. Well, you dug out if you want. Dug out if you want to, and I'll take this hour. But if you can stay, man, this could be hour or two of some interesting radio. Yeah. Interestingly enough, how about the Jews that were in the Capitol recently that were protesting for Palestine? That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, where you got January 6ers being charged with sedition, but yet, you know, here's this in an atmosphere, which I mentioned earlier on your show, where migrants in Europe, Muslim migrants, are being threatened with deportation, not for raping and killing and violence, but for supporting Palestine. Deport them now.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
Yeah, exactly. Very interesting.
And so you get into all this. And another thing I wanted to touch on, since we're obviously live doing hour two, is this infiltration of homosexuality in the alt-right. This is a phenomenon that I'm still trying to pick through, because, you know, most normal people that would migrate towards the alt-right or white nationalism would be, you know, against this. But yet in 2016, you had Peter Thiel, right, at the Republican whatever, when they inaugurated Trump as a Republican
nominee. Bilderberg Steering Committee member Peter Thiel.
Bro. Yeah. Bro. I mean, and then Lady MAGA. What even is Lady MAGA? And then Alex Jones interviewed some tranny. I can't even remember its name. You know, and Jones is like, yeah. You totally look like a woman. I would have you on my phone.
Hey, did you catch the interview Vivek Ramaswamy did with Alex Jones, by the way?
I think I heard about it.
That was interesting.
I've got my criticisms of Vivek, but go ahead.
Yeah. I caught a significant portion of that, and I thought it was interesting. I feel like Vivek gave Jones enough rope to hang himself a little bit on sort of unpacking his background and stuff like that. It's interesting how uncomfortable Alex Jones seemed talking about his background and how vague and you know, opaque he was about a lot of that. It's just, you know, it's the usual narrative stuff. Anyway, it was interesting, just as an aside.
And I want to give a little credit to, since we're on the air, let me just double check this live stream. You know, and Joe's like, yeah. Yep, we're on the air, Chris.
Right on.
And I want to give a little credit to Mike Sledge at American National Radio. They're pretty wild and hardcore. But, you know, I listen to all sorts to try to, you know, I don't want to listen to one source only. you know, and he was involved in the alt-right movement early on. He's exposed a lot of these people, and they were just talking about this movement, you know, and how the compromising of these people like Jones, you know, it's how could Jones be so uncomfortable with Vivek? Remember when Jones had Nick Fuentes and Ye on? Remember the whole Ye thing? you know, where Kanye West was talking about the Jews and got deplatformed and supposedly lost billions of dollars. He went from a billionaire to a low millionaire status.
Yeah.
But yet they got an audience with Trump and Jones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that? So I think that whole thing was odd.
Imagine that.
I hate to like slam people and put them under the bus, but I, you know, they're public figures, and I've listened to Nick Fuentes. I mean, he says some good stuff. But Ye, on the other hand, I mean, you know, after he did the whole Jew thing, then he did these weird, he got with this woman and he did these weird, like pagan looking pagan slash Christian videos. I mean, he really exposed who he was. I don't believe the man's a Christian. But I think these people are ops, dude. I think they're controlled oppositions. I think they did that for a reason. And there's a reason why they got, you know, an audience with Trump and Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason why Jones had him on. You know, John Statmiller used to say early on that Jones took a different path, you know, the path of funding by the establishment, if you will. And John wasn't willing to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why Alex Jones became a multimillionaire. And, you know, we got RBN today struggling, barely getting by.
Yeah. There's no, I like to joke, you know, and for people listening to this, what do you call it? You know, whatever it is, freestyle, you know, extemporaneous thing. I like to say there's no Ford Foundation grant coming. There's no Knight Foundation grant or whatever. No MacArthur, you know. We're not – RBN is never going to be underwritten by the forces that we would seek to dismantle, essentially. And if you're not familiar with the backstory on that discussion, look up the Reese Committee – in the early 1950s, go listen to what Norman Dodd said in the interview with G. Edward Griffin back in 1982. And get a copy of Rene Wormser's book, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Or listen to what Carol Quigley said in his speech, his lecture, The Myth of American Democracy, when he talked about corporations achieving the old Greek status of immortality. Anyway, support the network, though, is the point. Support the network, because you won't hear this stuff anywhere else.
And everybody has their favorite host. You know, one thing that I like about it, and I've listened to RBN all day. I've tried to listen on the weekends. I got to be honest, you know, this is the reason why I gave William my show on Fridays for the Punch Bowl, is I wanted to go out and do things.
Yeah.
And I got tired of content, so I sort of quit listening on the weekends. But there was a time when I listened to every RBN host,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to try to get rounded out and figure out what all their points of view were. And it's just fascinating, you know, that this one platform allows white nationalists, you know, John Moore would be more of a Cold War, you know, he's a Vietnam War vet. Lots of respect to John, by the way, but he's a kind of got an old school Cold War take. You know, I'm not slamming him per se. I'm just saying it's kind of, he needs to be updated a little bit. But he's got great guests on, and there's a lot of stuff you can glean from listening. You got your show, which focuses on the spiritual, you know, and then you get all the white nationalist stuff. There's something for everyone, and if you take it all in, you know, you can form your own viewpoint and opinion based on the truths that are put out, because everybody puts out some truths.
So,
even though you may not agree with their narrative.
Yeah. Can I maybe try to kind of come full circle on some of this stuff? You know, what you just said.
Yeah. Bring it on.
I keep, I keep thinking about the Alexander Dugin reference. You've mentioned Alexander Dugin a few times, and in conjunction with the alt-right, there was James Carly's 2017 HuffPost article, "Alexander Dugin, the Russian Mystic Behind America's Weird Far Right," and you know the old slogan is "Ordo ab Chao," out of order or out of chaos order, and you know. I was thinking earlier today, nation building, you know, when during the Obama administration, I talked about how Obama kept saying, "America, it's time for nation building here at home." And he said it several times. And people don't realize, you know, if you go read up over at RAND Corporation about nation building, that there is a destabilization that comes before that. You got to destabilize to stabilize and reconstruct. And do, you know, engage in stability operations. And so, you know, speaking of some of the other stuff earlier, I feel like that's happening in us as individuals as well. It's not just countries. There's an effort to destabilize us psychologically, emotionally, spiritually, even physiologically, to disrupt and remake man in every sort of conceivable way, if you will. But I think Dugin is one of the agents of chaos, in an effort to stabilize and reconstruct, you know, individuals and groups. But he, let me see, even his Wikipedia entry, under ideology, Eurasianism, and views on geopolitics. People don't understand, you know, a guy like this with the nuanced views that he has, it's like people are hanging out with Nosferatu and saying, "Oh, he's just a regular guy like all the rest of us." No, he has superpowers that you don't even comprehend, and he's not a regular guy. So anyway, from the Wikipedia entry in the early 1990s, what's that?
No, go ahead.
It says in the early 1990s, Dugin's work at the National Bolshevik Front, that should tell you something, included research into the roots of national movements and the activities of supporting esoteric groups in the first half of the 20th century. That's an interesting combination. Partnering with Christian Boucher, a then member of the French Ordo Templi Orientis, the OTO, and building on nationalist and migratory integrative interest groups in Asia and Europe. They contribute in bringing international politics closer to Russia's Eurasian geopolitical concept. And so, you know, he reminds me of, in a sense, he reminds me of someone like Serta Popovic, who is, I would say, who took up the mantle of Gene Sharp in the color revolution you know, crusade, so to speak. Speaking of, you know, Ordo ab Chao. So you got the OTO here. You can, you know, there are some interesting search results if you search Alexander Dugin, Aleister Crowley, for example. And so there, it's a short trip from that discussion to the Church of Thelema. And do as thou wilt is the whole of the law, is their, you know, their slogan or whatever. And this sort of brings me to what I've been saying recently. You said that Road Warrior Radio is the spiritual aspect of things. I think the Bible tells us very clearly in places like Ephesians 6, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. And it's so easy. This, a lot of the context of what we've been talking about is flesh and blood wrestling with flesh and blood, or being induced or compelled or coerced or nudged, manipulated, influenced, persuaded to wrestle with flesh and blood and not seeing the bigger picture. And so one of the things that's really struck me recently is this idea of who's in charge, who decides. And it started with the question from a friend about 15 or so years ago who said, you know, "Chris, I think communism is a religion. What do you think?" It took me a long time, about all of those 15 years, to finally go, holy cow, communism is the antithesis of the Pentecostal moment. And, you know, the slogan from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, sounds a lot like what's happening in Acts chapter 2. In Acts 2:45, for example, they all had everything in common. They were all selling and sharing as anyone had need. It sounds the same. What's the difference? The difference is the meta level context, which is who's in charge, who's deciding. And in Acts chapter 2, obviously, this is the outpouring of the Holy Spirit. It is the Pentecostal moment, the birth of the church. So it's God who's deciding. And the proof of that is when Peter confronts Ananias and Sapphira separately, and he doesn't say, "Why'd you lie to me or the state?" He says, "Why did you lie to God?" Versus this idea that, who was it that wrote that this we're all supposed to worship the state? A lot of guys have written that, you know, back to the Platonic era. Their idea is that the state is God, but I think that's a euphemism, and it's really a holographic front for, you know, the God of this world, 1 John 5:19. So the question ultimately is who's in charge, who decides? And I think all of these front groups and people like Dugin specifically are engineering chaos by getting people to essentially rise up and be their own God, to decide for themselves. And anyone who's been a part of anything in the last however many years in America can relate. I mean, the Alex Jones crowd certainly can say that, you know, they get this, the imperative message is always, we have to do something in our own strength, always. And no one's ever stopping and saying, hey, let's pray about this right now, and let's go apart. Let's, you know, separate, pray separately, and come back together, pray again, and then share what we feel like God has laid on our hearts. That's not happening. And
it's even featured in one of my commercials with P&J. We had Warren Baylog on as a guest. Mm-hmm. He was from Fast the Nation on TRS. Mm-hmm. And I think I asked the question, everybody calls into the radio station and they say, are we just going to talk about this? What are we going to do about it? Yeah. You know, and Baylog's response was, we either make the democracy work or we expose how undemocratic it is. Mm-hmm. And so there is this push to do something.
Yeah.
And you get this with Dugin. What I wanted to mention on Dugin, and I want to get back to the Acts 2 thing because I had some thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. You bring up so many interesting things. But with Dugin, you know, he wrote about the fourth political theory. Number one, he was astute enough to observe that the West was going to collapse under its own immorality.
Oh, but wait. Before we go too much further, again from Wikipedia, I'm just going to throw this out. Dugin was born in Moscow into the family of a colonel general in the GRU, so into a Spetsnaz family. Anyway.
So we had a little bit of – it wasn't just observation.
And while we're at it, might as well throw in – I mentioned the Reese Committee and what Norman Dodd – intimated to G. Edward Griffin, and the fact that basically the, you know, Norman Dodd's conversation with Horace Rowan Gaylor Jr., the newly minted Ford Foundation president at the time, just to paraphrase that, Norman Dodd shows up in the 50s at the Ford Foundation, and when he shows up, according to Norman Dodd, this is what he told G. Edward Griffin. He said, when I showed up, and again, I'm paraphrasing, he said that Gaither said, and Gaither is from an old school bad guy family, I would say. Anyway, Gaither says, I bet you want to know what we're up to here at the Ford Foundation. And Norman Dodd says, yeah, that's why I'm here. And so Gaither says, we, you know, come from, most of us come from, you know, OSS, Sullivan and Cromwell type backgrounds. And we operate on directives that issue from the White House, and you have to understand that this is not the White House per se. This is what, you know, Ralph McGahee wrote his book, Deadly Deceits, and he was the one who talked about the president's foreign policy advisors and the CIA. He was a career CIA guy who got the Career Intelligence Medal after 25 years of service, and he said, CIA is, you know, the covert action arm of the president's foreign policy advisors. and disinformation is a large part of their covert action responsibility. The American people are the primary target audience of its lies. Yeah, but they're not supposed to do domestic operation. Yeah, well, Mockingbird. Anyway, so Norman Dodd is talking to Gaither, and Gaither says, you know, most of us come from this kind of background. We operate on directives that issue from the White House and read president's foreign policy advisors, you know, counsel on foreign relations types. And he says, the substance of which is to so alter life in America as to create a comfortable merger between the Soviet Union and the United States. And that was in the 50s.
Getting into the point with Dugin, and I think you're backing up this point that he wasn't just observing then.
Yeah.
He was part of it.
Absolutely.
The end game is the Eurasian shift, the shift from Western power to Russia, China, you know, Iran, and all that. And Dugin, you could say, predicting the fall of the West.
Halford Mackinder called it the geographic pivot of history, and Brzezinski was all about that too. So anyway, yeah.
Well, we get from predictions to actively, you know, instigating and actively participating in the fall of the West. And I think that's where you're getting the alt-right movement catching on to Dugin's works. It wasn't happening fast enough. So let me say it plainly, you know, and I'm not all about Russia bad, you know, like Russian bad and everything else.
You're not good. A reductivist?
Right. but as a nuanced observer, I'm saying, like, yeah. I can't help but notice this alt-right's obsession with Russia and Dugin's works, a.k.a. Richard Spencer, and the active work with this man, with Dugin, in bringing about the fall of the West with the visions. At this, put all this together, Chris, 2013, 2014, just before the Maidan coup, you got the alt-right emerging. You got Trump being aggressively political on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go back and read these.
Yep.
You know, slamming Obama for you know, the whole Syrian thing. And you got the rise of Russia Insider, Bosman in Pennsylvania, the alt-right. Bosman's funding the alt-right. I've got that on very solid authority that Bosman funded a lot of members of the alt-right, specifically Mike Enoch and TRS. And you got this whole thing where maybe you have these Duginists fomenting, you know, this divide in the U.S. that was already there, I would add, but it's just being fomented and pushing it to a collapse, to shift to Eurasia.
Yeah, it was always absolutely. It was always intended, you know. And for that matter, you know, I think of the Fabian contingent. And H.G. Wells, The Shape of Things to Come, writing about stuff happening in Basra back in 1935. And, you know, because we have this American exceptionalist view where we look, you know, the world looks in, we don't look out. We think, no way, it's not possible. But, you know, again, read Anthony Sutton and realize that or, you know, for that matter, things like Manly P. Hall's The Secret Destiny of America. And none of this was an accident or coincidence. You and I talked this morning about the fact that most of the founders were, the movers and shakers were deists. That is something very different than Christian, which is why, you know, we can throw someone like Benjamin Franklin into that discussion. And some people might even consider him a Christian, which I would not, by any stretch of the imagination. And you realize that big macro picture, America has been used as the incubator of what I would call the modern Hellenistic push, which has always sought to return to Genesis 11 and finish what was unfinished there, what I call the great unfinished work. That's what the Great Reset represents in their minds, I think, where they're going to go back basically to Genesis 6 and make that whole deal permanent.
A lot of I mean, I would call America an experiment for the New Babylon.
Yeah.
Some people in Christian circles would call America itself the New Babylon and the Statue of Liberty, which is a pagan like statue. It's an idol to the Roman goddess Libertos.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say that it is the New Babylon. I don't hold that. I think the Bible has geographic areas that it sticks to, just like it sticks to the Table of Nations. And that, which is why America is not mentioned in biblical prophecy, because we're just a conglomerate of various European identities. And I want to get into that. I want to get into what is white and what is European. I want to get into that, bookmark that. But since America really isn't, okay, so, you know, you go under Japheth and you have Magog, which basically are Slavics. You know, you have Ashkenaz, which are basically German, Germanic, Anglo-Saxons. Gomer, you can get into the Celtics there. These are biblical nations.
That's Genesis 10, by the way, for people that are trying to track. Go to Genesis 10 and then, you know, branch out from there.
But when you get into prophecies like Ezekiel 38 and 39, they use these ancient nations.
And the correlation to Genesis 10. Yeah. And I think it's prophecy. I think it's a familial turf war. People think in nation in terms of nations, but the names that are mentioned are familial names. And so like you're saying, you know, trying to identify who's who in the zoo, it's not nations as much, kind of like Israel. Israel is not a nation state as much as, biblically speaking, it is the descendants of Jacob.
Biblically, yeah. Politically, the Israel that we observe is a political creation of modern Zionism. And who knows if they can trace back to biblical Israel. But the point that I was making is that America's not mentioned in prophecy because we're a conglomerate of different European identities, you know, with Africans thrown in there, descendants of Ham. And so at best, you could say maybe Ashkenaz is America, because through the last 250 years, mostly Anglo-Saxon Germanic peoples have ruled this country. I mean, you could make that case. But what I'm saying is it's not mentioned in prophecy because the biblical term of nation in the Greek ethnos and in the Hebrew goyim, I mean, it means a genetic group of people. And so when you get into white identity, which is another thing I wanted to talk to you about, you know, white, when you say white identity politics or white people, that's a social and political construct. What you're talking about are European nations, ethnic groups, Irish, you know, Celtic, Anglo-Saxon, Slavics, Italians, that make up this thing called America, right? And so this is something I've never been able to come to terms with the white nationalists. They want to identify as white because they want to do a political movement based on identity politics. And I'm like, well, there's something deeper than that. We have ancient European identities that were distinct even just only 80 years ago. They were very distinct. I mean, the Irish and the Germans immigrating into America in the early 20th century, you know, were looked at as a problem. As problematic, they were looked at as different than the Anglo-Saxon. So there's all of that to unpack. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not so convinced that America is not mentioned biblically. Specifically I could get into, I don't know. I probably won't do that right this moment, but I think I hold to a view that, you know, when you start talking about you know, the visions, Daniel's visions and the prophetic stuff, I really feel like, you know, the 10 kings and the kingdoms and the little horn territory and all that kind of stuff is it has more of a spiritual context, not so much a literal physical, similar to what I mentioned earlier. And I think because of that, we get led in ways that we don't realize. You know, there's the old adage that culture leads politics, and religion leads culture. And I think that's a hint at something much bigger, not religion so much. I think that's kind of misdirection, but I think that it's the spiritual battle that is raging in the unseen realm. And I think that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. And I think guys like Alexander Dugin are a direct connection to that. I think someone like Brzezinski, who praised Pierre Teilhard de Chardin in Between Two Ages, I think it was, America's Role in the Technotronic Era, you know, it's a hint at these nefarious forces. And that's the influence that, I mean, these guys are basically going and talking to, I mentioned in the break, I think, that Alice Bailey in the externalization of the hierarchy, when we were actually, you know, on, when we were supposed to be on last hour, I mentioned during the break around this time, actually about, I think, 10 minutes before in the break, that Alice Bailey wrote about that in the externalization of the hierarchy, and that they want to get people stirred up. And that's, you know, in an effort to foment this big social cataclysm. And that way, once you get everyone fighting, you can, I mean, it just sort of makes sense. You get everyone all stirred up and fighting, and then have somebody come in and say, hey, break it up, break it up, break it up. And that's the man of peace who will emerge on the scene and say, you know what, I'll make peace with everybody. Very charming, very charismatic, and maybe the abomination of desolation is in man. Maybe there's, you know, maybe the defiling of the temple is ultimately man.
In a Daniel 9 sort of way, I tend to think that the temple is literal. You know, you got 2 Thessalonians talk temple, Daniel 9, the 70 weeks. We're getting pretty deep here, but yeah. I want to bring this about. You know, what happens in the spiritual realm affects the physical realm.
Yeah.
You know, we learn from the book of Daniel that angels, both holy and fallen, represent different political systems and nations.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel, it was revealed to Daniel that the Medo-Persians would conquer the Babylonians and the Greeks. And they didn't mention Alexander the Great by name.
Yeah.
But definitely by actions.
Yeah.
You know, would conquer the Medo-Persians. And then he mentioned a fourth empire. So I think what happens spiritually, the spiritual battles do come to force in the physical realm in the form of empires. And this shift that we're seeing towards Eurasia, I think this is mentioned in Daniel 7 of the last global empire consuming the earth.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, for the last, 2,000 years, we've had a two-legged, you know, east and west division. It started with Rome when Rome broke up into the Western Empire and Byzantine.
Right.
Then the Ottomans took the eastern part. World War I pretty much took out the Ottomans.
Yep.
You had the British Empire. The American Empire replaced the British Empire.
Who actually won World War II? Anyway, a lot of people are reinvestigating that these days.
I think my point is that after emerging from World War II, you had the American Empire and the Soviet bloc.
Yeah,
of the Cold War, and then in the 90s, you had this window where the Soviets weren't all powerful, and America was like, "Let's do these 7 countries thing." And now you're seeing a whole shift.
Yeah, the non-plan.
Since the Ukrainian war, you're seeing this whole shift in Eurasia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of this was fomented and predicted and even instigated by the Duganists.
Yeah, and there's so much more. I mean, the port city of Neom, Saudi Arabia's Neom, $500 billion city, I think it is. Is it billion or million? I forget. It's a lot. And maybe it's 500 million. it was, whatever the case, it's expensive and they're going to have flying taxis in, you know, space age type stuff. And there's that other hotel they have that's like 100 kilometers long they're building in the sand. And there's China's investment in the New Silk Road, $1 trillion investment, which I think a lot of the Syria stuff has to do with, a lot of the Yemen stuff has to do with. I think there's a lot of stuff on the New Silk Road route that has to do with that stuff that most of us don't understand. But also, because again, we're Americans, we, you know, we don't look out. But you know, speaking of what you're talking about in the splitting up of the Roman Empire, you know, is this the beast that had a wound and died but didn't? I think of, you know, the British Empire. The empire, and you go back through history, the idea of the empire on which the sun never set is, that's an interesting thing. Most recently attributed to the British Empire, and we see British colonialism sort of retreating. The overt aspect of British colonialism retreating, and the Fabians coming on the scene in the late 19th century saying we need to recolonize the entire world in a kinder, gentler sort of way. And you know, I think that in my mind correlates to this ancient plan, you know, returning to Plato's Atlantis and Bacon's New Atlantis, and again the unfinished work of Genesis 11, and America is the tip of that spear. And I don't see it so much as American decline or experiment as much as America is the incubator of the spirit of communism, which is the antithesis of the Acts chapter 2 Pentecostal moment. Because again, who is in charge? Who decides? And one of the, and it should be a rhetorical question, it should be God Almighty, the creator of heaven and earth, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. One other point that I was going to mention when I talked about that earlier is there is this decision-making progress or process, excuse me. I would be remiss if I didn't mention the communitarian subject, because, you know, folks who listen to RBN, there are a number of them who, you know, talk about how communitarianism is kind of the, what I would call the amalgamation of all the worst aspects of governance, so to speak. And it's very much socialist in its roots. You know, you got guys like Saint Simon floating around. Auguste Comte is an essential figure in the ideology. But sociocracy, speaking of who's in charge, who decides, is this, I would say, it's a communitarian decision-making process where basically everyone sits around the table and we all say, hey, you know what, let's all make sure our voice is heard. And it sounds good, but again, from a Christian perspective, does anyone ever say, why don't we pray about this? Let's go our separate ways for a while, pray separately, come back together, pray together, and talk about what the Holy Spirit laid on our hearts. That never happens. It's not part of that process. So this is part of the counterfeit Hellenistic system from antiquity.
By the way, we're still live. I'm going to show for RBN. Please send some fundage. You know, invest in the you know, the marijuana thing. It's not marijuana. It's hemp. The hemp oil. I use that. It's great stuff. And get an underground bunker, because you never know when things are going to get bad. And give to RBN and support your favorite host while you're at it. So, getting back to the wounding of the beast, you know, Zechariah 11, and I think you showcased a video of this. I think that is a quite literal prophecy of the beast losing an eye.
Yeah.
In Zechariah 11, and it could, there could be some more application of that as you're putting out. But just to get back to this whole thing of white nationalism, why people are migrating to this, you know, you'd have the whole thing with Hitler came to power as a knee-jerk reaction to the Weimar Republic and the degeneracy that was happening there, financially and morally and all the like. This is why people migrate to this movement. It's because they see this as, you know, something wholesome. They heroize. What am I trying to say? They put Hitler up on a pedestal because he stood against these things, the degeneracy of the Weimar Republic. And so they say, well, I agree with that as well. And so that's why you get this movement. But getting back to the whole thing of returning to Babylon, in Babylon, God confounded the nations, the ethnicities, with language. He confounded their language. He wanted them to disperse. Acts 17 states that he, I think 26, that he gave them borders. And so the disintegration of borders, the mixing of ethnic nationalities, all of that's a return to Babylon. That's a return to Genesis 11. Just taking a 40,000-foot view of this, I think that's why you see a lot of Christian people migrating to this movement. Let me get your thoughts on that.
That's a lot.
Because, look, let me add this. In the Bible, okay, for you Christians, there is no scripture against what you would call race mixing. I don't like to use the term race, even though I said it in one of my commercials. There's the human race, okay? There's species that God created, animals and human. I don't believe in Darwinism or any of that nonsense. But there are ethnicities. There are ethnos, nations or ethnos in the Greek. Same word as goyim. And so you don't see any biblical command to not mix ethnicities, but it's the exception and not the rule. I mean, for example, Joseph married an Egyptian woman. His sons, Manasseh, and the other one, I just went blank. They were considered Israel. So you see, certain mixings in the Bible, but you don't see this as the norm.
So there's no divisions, and even people would say genocide. And so I can jump in here. So people who say, well, the Bible advocates genocide, I would say no. Like when Samuel tells Saul, God says, go utterly destroy the Amalekites, and you have the conflict with Moses in view. When they would raise Moses's hands, they were winning, yay, and then when his arms would go down, they would lose. They were losing in battle anyway. The Amalekites opposed these guys, and so God says, enough of them, utterly destroy everything. And that's an interesting thing that happens in 1 Samuel 15 and then what happens in 16. But response to people who would say that, the Bible advocates genocide is I don't think you understand the context of what you're reading. The Old Testament, may sound that way, but in my view, I'll just say it that way. What you're reading in those cases is the thwarting of Satan's attempts to preempt the arrival of the birth of Jesus, the arrival of Jesus Christ on the scene. And so that's why you have this marked delineation between the Old and New Testament, where the Old Testament is basically, God is cutting off, in those cases, God is cutting off the opportunity for Satan to try to take credit for anything. And that, I think, gets into the serpent seed discussion. Exactly what the details are, I don't think I could articulate. So that's not a cop-out.
I'm agreeing on a lot of these points. I want to push back on the genocide thing.
So before you do that, though, coming forward, you mentioned Acts 17, and that's Paul at the Areopagus which is awesome. Acts 17:23 says, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found," you know, he says, men of Athens, I see that you are very, I perceive that in all things you are too superstitious, or you're very religious, basically, his Mars Hill sermon. And he says, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you,'" which is, that's a bold move, man. I think if anybody did that in church today, like you walk into a Masonic lodge and you know, you guys worship the ineffable name, or, you know, the Gautu, the great architect of the universe, or whatever, what you ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. That's a bold move. But he's doing it, and this is quite a sermon. And, you know, you mentioned Acts 17:26, and it's, I think what is happening, you know, again, in correlation with that clash of civilization stuff, is we are being pulled apart in disingenuous, or I don't know, devilish sort of ways, diabolical ways, in order to collide us together and get us focusing on these lines of division that are specious. And I think we see it with all of this cultural nonsense. Again, this stuff is stuff that's been written, and going back to Pike's letter, you know, there was a post that was made not too long ago, talks about all this stuff, and it's a hoax. It's a Leo Taxil hoax. But you know, if you read Taxil's work, which was supposed to be discredited, it also seems to speak a lot to all of this stuff. So anyway.
Yeah, I would agree with a lot of that. Just from a 40,000 foot view, you know, that God separated the nations or the ethnicities, and to mix them and to blend them and to knock down borders is a return to Genesis 11. So, the new Babylon. So that's one thing. But I wanted to address the Old Testament view of genocide. I would have to push back. You talk about the curse of Canaan that God gave to Noah, who was a prophet. And the Canaanites were commanded to Israel by God to genocide certain of the Canaanite ethnicities. And the reason was, you get into the law, they were practicing sodomy, bestiality, child sacrifice, and God had determined them reprobates, basically, Roman one tier, too far gone, and he did command genocide. I would have to push back on that.
When you say push back, on what exactly?
On Old Testament commanding genocide. It did command genocide to certain ethnicities of the Canaanites,
but again,
that inhabited Palestine.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. But again, what my view of that is, so what happens if these people become prolific? Is there the serpent seed involved in there somewhere in a way that maybe I can't speak to specifically? I think so. So that, you know, because the genealogy of Jesus is confirmed, you know, father and mother in the Gospels. And so God's saying, this is, you know, he gets credit entirely. And there is no other group that maybe Satan can put his finger on and say, those are my people, and take credit.
Well, just to clarify, I'm not advocating genocide today to any group.
Nor am I. Yeah.
And, right. We're on the same page. And, you know, this is where the modern fake Israel political state would say, well, we're authorized for genocide because of Old Testament. No, that's not a thing. I'm saying there was a specific time.
You smell it?
Yeah.
I think Mike's back. There was a specific time and place in the Old Testament
where
God pronounced judgment on these particular nations of Canaan.
But again,
was prophesied, right?
But again, this validates the point, and for a specific purpose. And whose purpose? God's purpose. And so the question that I keep raising is, who's in charge? Who decides? And so the, let's say, we'll call them the Israelite people, by the way, or excuse me, today they're called Israelis, in the Bible they're called Israelites, but, you know, the, let's say, the Zionist contingent that says, you know, we have this biblical directive or whatever from the Tanakh or whatever you want to say, who's deciding? Who's praying, and where's the confirmation from God that, you know, that's a thing? Who's in charge? Who decides? So,
right.
I'm not advocating genocide either. I'm just saying that the Old Testament, this concept served a specific purpose. In my mind, it was to prevent Satan from being able to try to take credit for God's work, the arrival of the Savior of mankind.
Well, and in conjunction with that, it was God's judgment on a particular group of people.
Yeah.
That were reprobates.
Yep.
That he, and that was only for that time period.
Yeah, and that happens, and there are biblical, you know, references to those things, like, you know, basically, you know, to paraphrase Jesus' admonition in that regard, you know, the, you know, today's America would have to apologize, you know, we might have to apologize at the judgment seat to Sodom and Gomorrah.
You stole it!
Well, it seems like we got Mike back.
Yeah.
Mike, I guess you had to step away. We took this hour. Let's go back to programming as usual, because I'm on my fourth martini and I lost count of cigarettes. And Chris and I have just been going on and on. So if you have something you want to play at the 11 p.m. Central hour, go for it, my friend.
Yeah,
thanks,
so-
Chris, for- Go ahead.
Let me just throw this out there, and this, you know, I threw the bomb of the incendiary topic of the serpent seed out on Road Warrior Radio today when you were on in the second hour today earlier. You mentioned the curse of Canaan and the idea that Ham saw his father's nakedness is in view here, and you know, there's this idea that exposing things that are not supposed to be exposed, this to me gets to the heart of kind of the esoteric occult stuff that's going on these days with you know, the Kabbalistic. I mean, people can go on YouTube and listen to Michio Kaku and other theoretical physicists talking about how basically theoretical physicists are Kabbalists and vice versa, in a sense. Uncovering the father's nakedness, I think, is in view there. Exposing things or trying to break things apart that shouldn't be. I think there's a point at which we're not supposed to be doing that stuff. And it's, you know, again, trying to be God, trying to divine the secrets of the universe just without God.
Well, again, this was a very interesting discussion. I think it was necessary, and I hope the listeners enjoyed it. Mike, I hope you're back from your errand. And we'll see you guys tomorrow night on William and Jeremy.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
Yeah, man.
Enjoyed it.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
My name is John, the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You can't handle the truth.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today because you can handle the truth.